Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Seth Cohen of Intercultural Peace Builders, and we're going to be speaking to the good folks from the Bali Project. Right now, I would like to welcome from the Forest Guild, Howard Gross. He's the executive director of that organization. Xander Evans is research director, and Michael DeBonis is Southwest Region Director. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
So what is, starting with you, Howard, what is the Forest Guild? What's it all about? It's a national organization. Is it based right here in Santa Fe?
Sure, yeah. Well, we're an organization of more than 600 foresters, allied professionals, landowners, students, and other supporters who basically are very passionate about managing, protecting, and restoring forests. It's a very hands-on, on-the-ground organization. Our mission is to promote what we call excellent forestry, forestry that's ecologically, economically, and socially responsible. We have headquarters are here in Santa Fe, but we have volunteer coordinators and a couple staff in 12 states across the country. So we really have a nationwide presence in nearly all the major forested ecoregions of the country.
Is that mainly the West, or is it the whole country?
The whole country. We have probably a third of our membership is in New England. We have members on the West Coast, the Lake States region, the Southeast, and here in the Southwest. The Guild is... it's a pretty unique organization because of the land ethic that our members have, as well as the fact that we are managing forests. We are acknowledging and helping, manage forests for what human uses are in a long-term sustainable way. When I first came to the Guild, I was doing some research and I came across a reference to our organization as one for Loraxes with axes. And well, you know the Lorax from Dr. Seuss, right?
Vaguely.
Okay, well, he was one that was trying to protect the trees, and then someone was referring to us as Loraxes with axes, which really, to me, emphasized that we're viewed for principled stewardship, and, you know, that's something our members are known for.
So the Forest Guild is sponsoring a workshop called New Mexico Forestry and Climate Change Workshop, which is on Thursday, November 20th, next week. That's happening, I think, in Albuquerque. And let's talk about climate change, particularly as it affects Western forests. What are some of the realities of climate change and the predictions for climate change in the Western states?
This is Xander Evans, the research director, and I've been thinking a lot about this because not only do we have climate change, but we have a lot of other stressors on our forests. So particularly in the Southwest, we worry a lot about the history of fire suppression. So the forests are already in a state that's stressed.
And now, it may be counterintuitive for some people to think that not having fires is a stress on the forest.
And that's right. That's a very important point to emphasize, because these are fire-adapted forests. They grew up, or they became forests under the influence of fire. And so all the trees and the plants and even the animals are adapted to live with particularly low severity. So fires that don't kill a lot of trees and tend to be sort of cool ground fires.
And are caused by lightning strikes.
Yeah, this is a high lightning region. So one, particularly before lots of human occupation, one lightning strike would start a fire that would carry across a large, large area. And now, of course, with a lot of roads breaking things up, a lot of fragmentation, those lightning strikes wouldn't burn as large an area. So even fragmentation alone would change the way fires burned in our forests and the way the fires or the way the forests interact. But
there's more than that too.
Yeah, and then you add climate change on as another stressor on top of that, and all the impacts of fire suppression are just made worse. So for example, because of the lack of fire, there are many more small trees in ponderosa pine forests than are historically or naturally there. And those small trees, because there's so much competition between them, they're all small and weak. And now when you do have a fire burn through, instead of being a cool ground fire, it tends to be what's often referred to as catastrophic, fire that burns through the crowns and kills not just those small trees, but all the trees. And we've seen those sorts of fires in New Mexico recently.
And everybody who lives in the tops of the trees.
Right, or throughout the forest. So it's rather than having sort of a renewing small fire that runs to the ground, you're having a fire rip through the whole forest. And those are likely to be more common with climate change because of warmer temperatures, and the predictions on precipitation are a little bit up in the air, but even if precipitation stays the same, the warmer temperatures and the periodicity of the precipitation is going to mean that there's less available for the trees.
What do you mean by periodicity?
That refers to when the rain comes, and those of us who live in New Mexico know that we tend to get a fair amount of moisture in the winter and then a fair amount during the monsoons. And so if you have less snowpack, then that melt in the spring occurs earlier and the trees dry out, the ground dries out earlier into the summer. So then they're more stressed. They don't have the water they need to grow and fight off various things like insects and disease, and so they become weaker.
What's the relationship between warmer temperatures and less dryness and insect infestations in forests?
Well, we were actually talking about this on the way over. In pinon juniper, we saw in 2003 an outbreak of bark beetles. And some research has shown that these are the kinds of, whether that or not that particular outbreak was driven by climate change, it's the kind of outbreak that we may see more frequently with climate change. Similarly, in Colorado, there's a big outbreak of bark beetles. And again, while it may not be specifically driven by climate change, it may be aided and embedded by climate change. Warmer temperatures, for example, allow bark beetles to have more generations per year. So you can have more bark beetles in a shorter time, overwhelming the trees.
And then there's the tree's immune system against bark beetles.
Yeah, the amount of water allows more resin flow. So, for example, a bark beetle goes into a tree and the tree essentially pitches it out using the resin and the pitch. And if the tree is water stressed, it doesn't have the amount of resin it needs to pitch out the hundreds of bark beetles attacking it. So there is this direct link. If a tree is killed by bark beetles, then it's more flammable. So you can have all these stressors interacting together to provide a pretty difficult situation for trees, which then can change the composition of our forests.
Let's talk about not only forests, but the relationship between forests and the communities who live near them. Michael Devanis, you're involved with what is called, I think, community-based forest management.
Sure, and you know, we've talked a little bit the last few minutes about healthy forests and ecological forestry, but really, you can't have good forestry if you don't have viable communities. And in the Southwest and in New Mexico, we have generations of folks that have carved out a living based on the forest, harvesting wood, utilizing wood, whether it be for cooking and heating or making forest products. And so a lot of the work, forestry work that takes place in the Southwest is focused on improving the health of the forest, but also improving the health of communities. It's giving communities and these forest workers and contractors an opportunity to make a living from the land.
So what's an example of that?
So one example would be One thing we've worked on in the past few years is a particular barrier to getting work done in the woods. And every contractor that works in the woods has to carry insurance. And insurance costs in New Mexico were really high. People were paying $70 for every $100 they paid in payroll.
So Good heavens.
Yeah. So what it basically said is you either didn't pay insurance at all or you had to do so much work and make so much money that you could cover those costs. So over a period of a couple of years, we had partners from the insurance industry, federal agencies, state agencies, and forest workers that developed a safety training program that forest workers in New Mexico could participate in that enabled them to lower their workers' compensation insurance rate. So they were paying $70 for every $100 in payroll, and it went down to $30. So basically what that means is folks could get out in the woods, they could do that work, and they could be competitive for contracts, and they could at least have a shot at making a living off the land.
And probably not break their neck while they're at it.
Right. We like to think that folks are working a little safer out there, and I think the safety records show that.
So what is the role of economic reality of forests in New Mexico? I mean, we don't have the gigantic old growth timber forests and the logging industries that like to cut them down. What do we have?
Well, the days of big forest industry cutting a lot of wood out the land and using that wood in mills to make a variety of forest products are are gone. Those days are over. And not to say that there isn't a use of the wood anymore, but I think what folks need to think about is what's the appropriate way, what's the appropriate scale. And our trees are different. As Xander mentioned, we have trees that are smaller, are tend to be, grow close together, and aren't as big as some of the trees that we may have had historically or that grow in other parts of the country. And what we're seeing are the new markets, are new ways to utilize those types of trees in the industries. And one of them is biomass utilization. Another one is creating wood products from the small trees that can be marketed locally or used locally in building products or bedding for animals or other sort of innovative uses. So I think developing these types of industries that are based on the materials that we have, based on good forestry, and based on supporting community economic goals is the way to go.
So you have a situation where you've got too much fuel in the forest, which makes for catastrophic fires, and you also have the possibility of using biomass to actually heat buildings. Santa Fe Community College has a program. Is there a way to get some of that extra unburned fuel out of the forest and use it for biomass?
There certainly is, and that's I think a nice combination. We were talking earlier about sort of the threats of climate change. Well, here's an opportunity to kind of mitigate those by burning material from the woods that we'd prefer wasn't there in the first place. We can also offset our use of fossil fuel, so we don't have to burn as much oil because we're burning this wood. So right there...
Is it carbon neutral to burn wood?
Not technically. It's not neutral. But there certainly is a huge carbon bonus. So
I mean, they're photosynthesized. The trees are photosynthesizing before you burn them.
So you sequester a lot of carbon when your trees grow, whether they're small trees or big trees. And then that carbon can be released when you burn them. You do lose a little bit because you got to use fossil fuels to cut them down and haul them. But that is minuscule. So essentially they're carbon neutral, but people say that and they quibble about the exact numbers because you do lose a little bit in the transfer.
But as you say, it's nothing compared to burning petroleum.
And it's a huge bonus. And then, of course, there's an employment factor because then you have people out there working in the woods to remove these trees and then having a market for them rather than feeling like, well, we need to cut them down for fire safety or ecological restoration, but now we don't know what to do with them. Now you're creating markets for them.
So when you talk about restoration of forests, first of all, do you want to restore forests? How have forests been compromised, and then how do you want to restore them in an era of climate change to where they were 100 years ago to where they are now in a different climate?
I think that's a very tricky question because the predictions for exactly how climate will change are uncertain. So a lot of people say, well, we know that forests were in a stable situation before a lot of Europeans got into the area and started doing things like running a lot of sheep around, suppressing fires, changing the ecology.
Now, they were stable, but they still had life cycles and patterns of development where one kind of tree supplanted another and so on.
So that's why we refer to something called the historic range of variation. So the goal with restoration is to move an ecosystem back into a range where it was healthy. So you're not saying, I want to restore it to the way it was on April 17th, 1862. You're saying, I want to restore it to how it was more or less during this period. So that has, for example, big trees, fairly large spacings, ground cover that would carry a low-intensity fire, rather than a lot of small trees packed in and no ground cover.
So how do you go about, once you set your goals, and that's something that we could talk about for the next 2 hours, but how do you actually go about doing restoration work?
Well, one of the things is you want someone who is either well-experienced or well-trained to identify which trees should come out. So it's not just sort of willy-nilly, but you want to identify particularly pre-settlement trees. Maybe you want to look at the particular site and say, is this a south-facing slope? So maybe it had fewer trees than a north-facing slope. And you can bring in the potential impacts of climate change and say, well, we have some reason to believe it had this kind of makeup in 1880, but now it's going to be a little drier, so maybe we want to reduce the tree density a little bit more. Or in the case of mixed conifer, sort of the forest type above ponderosa pine in elevation, that may shift a little bit and look more like ponderosa pine. So if you're managing a mixed conifer forest, you might encourage the individual ponderosa pine trees in that mix and shift management a little bit to encourage a type of forest that's more resistant to drought.
I'd also want to throw in that, you know, one change in restoration that climate change is forcing is a view that we maybe aren't restoring back to what the forest was in the past, because the climatic conditions that we have in the future might not be such that the forest of the past would survive in the future under that climate. The other thing is that, you know, there's a lot of connected parts in an ecosystem, and considering, so it takes a very interdisciplinary approach, I think. You know, we want to understand the role of animal populations, say, in dispersing seeds. So if we're going to try to restore a forest somewhere, we want to make sure that the critters that belong there are going to be part of that system. And, you know, there's just so many links within ecosystems between plants and animals and processes. So anything we try related to forest, related to climate change in the way of forest management needs to be experimental in its approach. You know, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is you don't throw out any of the pieces. So anything we try, we want to be able to try in an experimental way and also back off on if it's not working. You know, these approaches kind of turn some conventional wisdom on its head. When we talk about genetic material and restoration, typically the approach has been to use seeds that were from local, you know, local vegetation, local seed stock. Well, now the thinking and the discussions are focusing around, you want a genotype that can tolerate a diversity of environmental conditions. You may want to have different genotypes because the climate's going to change so much, potentially, that the forest, you know, the species that were in a particular, at a particular elevation, a particular spot in the landscape, might not be the best suited to be in that spot 50 years from now.
And so you're talking about the dreaded introduction of non-native species?
No, just different, an increased genetic diversity amongst the same species that are there.
Maybe a good example is, for years, the forest industry was pushing for trees that grew fast and tall. And now I think we all recognize that we want other attributes in our tree population. So trees that maybe can survive drought or survive bark beetles better than their neighbors. So it's that genetic mix that Howard's talking about.
Let's go back to the people piece of this. So forests are managed by bureaucrats, by forest employees, basically government employees more by and large. Is that correct?
It depends on who owns the land, but you bring up a good point. Now, if I were in charge and I were able to tell everyone how to manage their forest, you know, I'm not exactly sure if the outcome would be exactly what everyone wanted. And so instead of having that, what you need to do is involve multiple people. And what we've seen work really well in New Mexico is collaboration. So you have those landowners, you have those bureaucrats, those forest managers, but it doesn't tell the whole story. It doesn't give you all the information. So you need to have the contractors, the folks that are actually going to cut the trees. You need to have the community members, you need to have the wildlife folks and the folks that are going to utilize the wood to try to figure out, all right, we know that we need to do something in this forest. We know that it's unhealthy and we need to utilize the wood. Well, what's the best way to go in there and make the forest healthier, but also meet our economic goals in the community, help out the people that are working and trying to make a living from the woods? And it's a process that we call it collaboration. It's really easy to say and it's pretty hard to do. It takes a lot of time. You've got to put the time in there to get people together.
But that's what you do. That's what the Forest Guild does.
That's what we do. Yeah. It's beautiful when you see it happen, because people are happy with the work that happens on the land, and you see strong economies, and you actually see people growing. And we've got a program that we've been working with, the Forest Guild Youth Corps program, where, you know, if you don't have any foresters and you don't have any community leaders, you know, we wouldn't be having this discussion. And we've seen through this program where we train kids in different aspects of natural resource management, you see that spark. You see them really get a glow in their eyes when they talk about forest management. And we've seen some of these kids go into forestry as a career. And some of these folks are working for agencies. Some of these folks are the landowners.
Now, New Mexico, as I understand it, is actually kind of a model state in terms of the type of collaboration we're doing.
Yeah, we're fortunate to have a program here called the Collaborative Forest Restoration Program. It's a grant program that's from the U.S. Forest Service, and that program funds projects, forest restoration projects that are developed collaboratively and implemented collaboratively. And so you've got the folks that are coming together early on in the process to decide what type of forest restoration is going to take place on the land. Then they're involved in the project as far as getting that work done. And then interestingly, they're involved in actually looking to see if their goals were met. So they collect information from the forest on, you know, the ecological information of did we do what we said we were going to do, but also were our social and ecological goals met. And based on that information, they can then go back and make changes to get better results. So we're very fortunate to have that program here, and we've seen some good work happen on the land.
So we're just about out of time, but I want to remind people that the New Mexico Forestry and Climate Change Workshop is on Thursday, the 20th of November. That's next week from 8 to 5. It's taking place in Albuquerque. People can go to forestguild.org for more information. Who should be going to this workshop, Howard Gross?
Forest managers, researchers, landowners, students, activists, really anyone from the general public that is interested in learning about forest management, interested in learning about climate change, interested in hearing some of the latest discussions and ideas about managing our forests in the face of climate change and uncertainty.
And so if just a regular member of the general public went, there would be something for them?
I think so. I mean, there certainly will be some jargon and, you know, technical information, but there's some overview talks that I think are going to keep things at a high level. So hopefully something for everyone.
And once again, for more information, people can go to forestguild.org. Is there a phone number people can call?
Sure. 983-8992, extension 42.
Howard Gross is the executive director of the Forest Guild. Sandra Evans is research director. And Michael DeBonis is Southwest Region director. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. And thanks for what you do for our community with this program. We appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Seth Cohen. He is the founder of Intercultural Peace Builders. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So what is Intercultural Peace Builders? How did you start this organization?
Well, it's a new nonprofit that supports grassroots conflict transformation, which is another word for conflict resolution, and peace building at the local level, mostly abroad in some of the places where I have had a chance to work in the past as a facilitator and a mediator, in Eastern Africa, Northeast India, in the state of Assam, and also We're also currently doing some projects in Bolivia. And it came about as a result of the work that I had been doing primarily on my own and from time to time through projects that were supported by the U.S. Embassy. And I came to realize through some of those projects the shortcomings of the conflict resolution work that was being done with communities and how we could possibly develop some more sustainable grassroots approach that supported local wisdom and local knowledge. And I formed some relationships with people in those communities that invited me to help them kind of develop some ideas and support some projects that we've been trying to follow through with. That was kind of the inspiration for starting.
So let's talk about, for example, Africa. You were in Kenya.
I was in Western Kenya and also in Uganda and Tanzania.
So you
in 2004.
Seth shows up from the United States and says, here, I've come to make peace. Now, how does it work?
Well, it's not quite like that. And I actually have pretty strong feelings about that kind of outside intervention approach. I met a group of East Africans in the United States in 2004 who were here visiting places to find out more about conflict resolution in the U.S. and also to share their own experiences in traditional conflict resolution mechanisms back in Africa. So we had some interesting dialogues here in Washington, D.C., and actually here in Santa Fe, too. They happened to come to both places. And a couple of them turned into friendships, and they invited me to come to Uganda to do some programs in the schools because I had been working as a mediator in the Santa Fe Public Schools. And I had some ideas about violence prevention and working with youth and teachers and also parents who sometimes play a big role in the conflicts between students at schools. So that's how that first project in Africa came about. It was I was invited by them to come, and then we shared ideas and developed a program. They actually asked for some support from the U.S. Embassy to fund the project.
What kind of problems were they having? I mean, what was some of the specifics?
Well, the project, they were quite different from the kind of problems that we were having here. Some of the specifics problems that they were having in Uganda were tensions between students and teachers and administration over the fees that were being charged for kids to go to school at what were supposed to be public schools, but they had to come up with quite a bit of money for books, sometimes for school uniforms, and couldn't afford that. So often it turned to be into student strikes and demonstrations, which sometimes led to the burning of schools, the burning of libraries, parents, you know, kind of pushing the kids to try and get a headmaster kicked out of the school because they didn't like them. And so that was basically delaying the functioning of the school in everyday life. So they were looking at ways, and typically these had been handled in very punitive manners. So they were looking at ways to try and get the students actually involved in the problem-solving approaches and coming up with ways to maybe develop a mediation program in the schools.
And so you were involved with that?
I was involved with
that.
So
what did it look like? I mean, what were you able to do?
Well, what we did is we did a couple of workshops, usually about 4 days long, because, you know, there wasn't time to do much in one-day workshop. And we had students, teachers, administrators, and parents come and look at the root causes of the problems. They kind of explained what the problems were. They tried to identify where these problems were starting from, who were the key players and the actors in this conflict, how was the community involved. And then they began to look at ways to form relationships between some of these key actors, like how could they come together, explore ways to maybe come up with new ideas that, you know, to address things that weren't working before. Then we had a day where we just looked at traditional conflict mechanisms in Africa and said, what have you guys done in the past to resolve conflicts? You know, how have the elders been involved? How have youth been involved or not been involved? What is the role of women? And they basically looked at what were the shortcomings and decided, you know, these are areas that we need to, you know, maybe put more attention to and see if we can improve the situation in everyday life in the schools. And so that's one example.
And did it work?
From what I can tell from the relationships I've had with, you know, following up with people, I'm still in touch with the main guy that invited me down there. His name is Sentongo Ashad, and he's actually now here in the States doing a PhD in conflict resolution, which is pretty interesting, a result of that whole program. But his brother owns one of the schools, and he said, you know, they've been trying to implement, many of the schools have implemented a lot of the things that came out of that workshop, some with varying degrees of success. So that was, you know, the very first project I did in a very, in an African intercultural setting, and was kind of an inspiration for starting the Intercultural Peace Builders, which has since expanded into quite a few different areas.
We're talking to Seth Cohen. The organization is Intercultural Peace Builders. The role of women, which you mentioned just a moment ago, is important in a number of the places that you have done work.
Yes, it is. But unfortunately, a lot of times the women are quite marginalized in terms of how much they can actually participate in problem solving in a public setting. It seems like, from my experience, I noticed that they're definitely playing a crucial role behind the scenes. But the people that have invited me are usually pretty educated and conscious people of the need to involve women more. So, for example, this summer I was in Assam in northeast India, and I was invited there by a group of young men in their 30s who are studying their master's degree in conflict resolution and public policy in New Delhi, but they're from this remote part of India. And so we went around to different communities and interviewed village leaders. We tried to interview women in the community. We interviewed youth about what were the actual conflicts that were going on and who was involved in trying to improve the communities. And we discovered that sometimes women played a really key role, but oftentimes they were kind of ignored by some of the village headsmen, for example, or even the local politicians. So that became something that these young men that invited me are now focusing on, like how to put extra effort and attention into these women leaders, because they seem to be having a very big impact in some areas, like starting new cooperatives for new economic opportunities, being more involved in the local political scene. One of the things that I found quite interesting was that in these village meetings, when the women would not be as shy to point out men who were taking advantage of the system. For example, there was corruption in the community, and the women would point out that this particular person was using money that should be used for educational development in other ways, but the men would not point out their comrades or their friends in a public setting. So they saw that as a pretty interesting aspect of the role of women, and that people would feel more accountable to what they said in front of others.
What is the nature of the conflicts in Assam and Northeast India that you were dealing with and that you were trying to help people with?
Well, the Northeast of India is made up of seven different states that are largely cut off from the rest of India. There's a little bit of border called the Chicken Neck, which is about 23 kilometers wide, that connects it to the main part of India. Otherwise, it's surrounded by Bangladesh, Burma, Tibet, and Bhutan, I believe. If I left one off, I'm sorry. And so those people mainly come from those areas historically. They don't relate or identify as much with the rest of India. But they've been, when the British left and India became, like, you know, its own country, they just became kind of folded into what is now the modern day complexity of India. And they are not, they're cut off from the borders of these other countries where a lot of their indigenous roots come from. So they feel extremely marginalized and cut off from the mainland of India and from the government in Delhi. So there's a lot of different insurgency groups that have taken up arms trying to claim land rights, additional funding from the central government to develop those areas, which have been really marginalized and underdeveloped. There's lack of schools. There's a lot of flooding in Assam from the Brahmaputra River, which is one of the largest rivers in the world, and they just don't get the help they need. So the conflicts are often between people that live there and the central government, but they've been going on for, say, 40, 50 years without a lot of success. So now at the local level, some people are tired of the conflicts, and they want to come up with new strategies for just creating peace in their own communities, developing new economic opportunities. Because youth usually turn to guns and to arms when they're frustrated by the lack of socioeconomic opportunities in their home regions.
So when you were there offering what it is you do, how do you take into account the economic realities and the factionalism and the politics of that situation in the peace building process?
Well, I learned very quickly that it's extremely complex there in the northeast of India. I mean, there's not only the tensions between the government and these insurgency groups, but there is also a huge impact from Bangladeshi migrants coming into Assam, India. Not unlike other border situations where the new immigrant population is seen as a threat by the local Assamese people. And so they see that the local politicians want those migrants to be there because it creates a larger voter base for them. So there's what we did. We didn't think that we could solve those types of issues, and I certainly didn't. I was there more as a listener, as a facilitator, and to support these young men who invited me. But to show you, like, to give you an example of what's come out of that, we spent this month, you know, talking to village elders, talking to student union leaders, talking to local politicians. And now then the young men who invited me formed a small committee, much like an NGO here called the Eastern Network, of youth that are all from that area, from affected communities. And they decided, how do we want to focus our energy based on what we learned in this 1 month study? And they decided that it was best to put their energy into a few tribes that were extremely marginalized, that had for the most part, avoided conflict and find out how have these tribes avoided conflict? What have they used traditionally in terms of conflict resolution or peacemaking to not fall victim to these larger conflicts that are throughout northeastern India? So now Intercultural Peace Builders is helping them to develop the ideas and also to raise money for workshops and dialogue circles in those communities.
Where they literally dialogue circles. People sit around in a circle.
Literally, they pretty much are. Like, when we went, we would go to these remote villages that sometimes took us 4 and 5 hours there, and we would sit outside, sometimes under trees, sometimes under these thatched huts, and there would be 4 or 5 community leaders and then a larger circle of people that were from the community sitting around who were interested. And when they were invited by their, you know, community leaders to speak and share their ideas and opinions, they would do so. So that's kind of the idea and the starting point for developing some sustainable long-term approaches to tackling some of these. There's a lot of overt violence, but also just kind of underlying tensions in these communities. And, you know, their people were quite receptive to people to these young men who were from the communities actually trying to start something, because people are pretty impoverished in these areas and they really just don't have the time or energy to step out of their daily lives and to explore these problems and to look for ways to overcome them. But they have a lot of interest in doing so. They need support and help in doing it.
So when somebody from their community provides leadership and you support that leadership, something can really happen.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I mean, coming back to my role as an outsider, I wouldn't say fortunately or unfortunately. I'm learning and I have mixed opinions about it. Sometimes my being there is like a catalyst for discussion and for conversation. People see that, you know, someone from far away has come and they're interested in what's going on here. Someone's taken an interest in us. You know, let's listen to him. Let's also share our stories with them. And people really open up once that level of trust is built. And, you know, that's why it's very important for me to always go with someone who invites me, who's local from the community, so that that trust is there.
Seth Cohen is the founder of Intercultural Peace Builders, and they can be found on the web at icpeacebuilders.org. That's all one word. And they are having an event this Thursday, the 13th of November, a slideshow fundraiser. It's a raffle, a silent auction, and Seth will be there, and lots of good stuff from 6 to 9 at the Shiprock Gallery at 53 Old Santa Fe Trail. That's right near the plaza. It's an upstairs gallery.
It's upstairs on the plaza, and that it's a building that's on the corner of, I believe it's Washington and Palace, but the stairway up it faces the plaza.
But Washington Palace. Okay, it's 53. It's called 53 Old Santa Fe Trail.
It's on Old Santa Fe Trail, though.
Okay, well, Seth.
No, I'm sorry. Then it's Old Santa Fe Trail and Palace. That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Seth Cohen, thank you so much for being with us. Is there a phone number people can call for more info?
Yes. In fact, if you'd like to come to the event or just find out more about Intercultural Peace Builders, you can call me at 660-0447.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Galen Duke and Xenia Victor. They started the Bali Project, and they've been doing that for about 10 years. And Nancy Sue Michaels and Lucy Clark, who are involved also in the Bali Project, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to see you all. Now, we've had you on the air before, and we wanted to update people about this wonderful project that you do. Galen and Xenia, why did you start this project? What's it all about?
Well, we started it because we felt that young Americans were not traveling, and that being we're the superpower and the world is so important to know. My father died, we got a little inheritance, and we began it.
And you came up during a time where young people were backpacking all over the
all
world.
All over the place. I was on the first student ship, which was an old army ship. We all slept in bunks, you know.
And so what is this project is high school juniors from the Santa Fe school system.
Not the school system, Santa Fe area.
The Santa Fe area, okay.
So they can be from any of the different schools. We've had about 10 different schools with kids represented, and we limited it to this area because we have about 10 meetings ahead of time, and we want them to be able to get here and attend it.
And so what do they actually do? You choose a pretty small number of students, and they go to Bali for part of the summer.
We go for a month of June, and I think a lot of what they do, we might let Lucy talk about it later, but we set up a program in Bali with Balinese teachers in music, dance, painting, batik, and so on. And the kids take classes and with the local teachers, some of them we've known 30 years, and the kids just get to become Balinese for a month.
And they become Balinese. Now, Lucy Clark is a student who's been on this trip. Did you go to Bali last summer?
Yeah, I went last summer.
What is it like to become Balinese for this summer?
It was probably the most amazing experience I've had up to date in my life. It completely changed my point of view on everything.
What are some examples of that? What changed for you?
Just seeing, being in a different culture, especially like such a communal culture versus like an individualistic culture, was really different for me, and it really just made me aware that we're all humans, and like it was just a beautiful experience.
So what did you do on an average day?
Well, we took classes. We took dance classes, painting classes, gamelan and tinglet classes, which was a lot of fun. And we learned a lot of the language in our meetings before. So, you could talk to people in Indonesian, which was fun because I've never learned a different language. And we went to different temples and really just immersed ourselves in the culture and learned a lot.
And so how have you kept it with you since then?
Well, it's hard to describe. A lot of people have asked me how I changed, and we kind of talked about this, like you're going to be so different, but you won't really be able to explain it, and I can't. Like, I know that I've changed in this massive way, but it's hard to put into words. It's sort of like a personal, intimate change. But I'm just really kind of more open to the world now, and I really want to travel more now as well.
I would think that is one of the results of this, is that people who go to Bali end up becoming perhaps world travelers more than they otherwise might have been.
Well, it's amazing. We've taken now over 70 kids, and they've been to Zambia, they've been to Cambodia, China, India, and not just, some of them are traveling, but most of them are like giving service in a refugee camp, or learning Chinese, or teaching. So one is teaching English in China. They're working in an orphanage in India. It's just extraordinary what they're doing. Yeah.
Nancy Sue, you went on the what's called the adult program.
Two times
as
a teacher. So when Galen had invited me to go, I thought he meant being a chaperone, and he said, oh, no.
Chaperone, that sounds like fun.
Well, I would have gone anyway. I was like, whatever you want me to do. But he said, no, your role is just to go there, enjoy it, relax, participate, learn, which is exactly what I did. And it was delightful. And one thing in terms of the day in life, it's like waking up at the crack of dawn and going for a walk on the rice paddies and seeing the rice farmers and just the Balinese everyday people working and greeting them and being greeted with huge smiles and just such generosity of heart. And everybody just happy to talk to you and just so happy that you're there. And it's just an amazing way to start the day, to just to be out there like that, to see how, well, for one thing, how just daily living is much more challenging and a lot physically demanding, working in the rice paddies and all that, and than what we have to do here. So that was a great appreciation, like how hard people work for their food every day. And that I don't have to work that hard for my food, but I realize my rice paddy is my classroom. Like that's what I have to do every day to grow my rice. You know, it's sort of a different, it's a little bit more removed, but not really if I stop to think about it. So just, I've gained a whole lot more gratitude for just life, everyday life.
You are an artist and you teach art. How did it affect your work and your teaching to go to Bali?
Well, I loved being a student, first of all, when I was there. It was so much fun to learn from the teachers. And what was so sweet was, the word generosity comes up, is how generous the teachers were there. Like, they just were so generous in everything that they gave. And And it's funny because we joke about this, that in Bali, well, here there's this like unspoken, you never work on anybody else. You don't touch anybody else's artwork. And there, they're like, oh, well, this is how you do it. And they're right in the work and they're showing you right on the piece. It's sort of like, in a way, almost less precious. And that was very freeing for me to sort of take away some of the rules. And also we were really learning from masters. But there is still this humility that they taught with, even though they're these amazing teachers, they're very accomplished in their culture, but they come and they're teaching us and they're just so happy to have us there. They're so happy to have me as their student and to learn from each other, and it's just delightful in that way.
Galen, you and Xenia are, as we've talked about, people who've done an awful lot of traveling in your lives. Why did you choose Bali?
Well, we've been all over the world, and when we wanted to do this program, we made a list of where we could do things like this, and there was Bali, and then there was everything else about 10 feet below it. The people, the culture, the just everything. It's just, if you haven't been there, you can't possibly imagine how giving and sharing it is to be in Bali. It's just...
Where does that come from culturally? Is it a religious thing? Why are they like that?
I don't know, because there are other Hindus that aren't that way, and there are other people on islands that aren't that way. They just have this combination of everything that just makes them... sharing. The Balinese say that when you die, you go to Bali. and that's how they live it.
And ladies and gentlemen, you can go there without dying.
they say that when you... I was headed somewhere with that, but it doesn't matter. The Balinese think that after one day of a tourist being in Bali, then they're Balinese. And they treat you like you've been there forever, and they want you to stay forever. It's just... We walk downtown every morning, and from our hotel to downtown is about a half a mile, and the first day it takes about 10 minutes. The last day it takes about a half an hour or so, because I have to stop and talk to everybody along the way. All your friends is on you. Don't just rush by anybody without stopping and having a conversation.
Now, one of the ways in which this program works is that the students who are selected then go on to fundraise for their trips.
Right.
Tell us more about that.
What we do, and this next Sunday we're having the meeting to tell people more about it. So at the end I'd like to say what time it is and all that. We get together, and the students who are accepted, because we interview people, we usually interview around 30 and accept 8. And once the 8 are accepted, we go. But we all fundraise together. So it's not that each student has to give a certain amount of money. There's no question about that.
Choose the young people, and then regardless of their economic ability to pay, and then they raise money and go.
Yeah. In fact, we are looking for students who really couldn't afford to do it on their own and haven't traveled. Because it's our idea is to open the world to those who couldn't have done it.
So there's a meeting this Sunday at 3 o'clock,
right.
Sunday, November 16th at 3 o'clock. And for more information, people can go to baliartproject.org. And they can also call you at 988-7209. And they're just welcome to
come. And we encourage them to bring their parents.
Yes.
Yes.
And so, and what about adults?
And we have the adult sponsor trip. The adults pay for their own trip plus make a contribution to the students, and they too are chosen.
And that's part of how the fundraising works,
right,
is that
right.
The adults are required to kick in.
Right, right.
Except for the teacher program that Nancy Sue is part of.
Oh, okay.
And in that, for teachers, they pay their airfare and we pay everything else.
So baliproject.org is the website. Galen Duke, Xenia Victor, Nancy Sue Michaels, and Lucy Clark, thank you all so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick Appalucci for engineering today and Marilyn LeBlanc. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.